Well, every year, at about this time of year, people begin to formulate New Year's resolutions. They think about the habits that they have, maybe some of the mistakes they've made from the previous year, and things they'd like to see different the next year. I will share with you right now one of the few things that has always been elusive to me, an enemy of mine that I have fought against since I was very, very young. Donuts. And every year I ponder if maybe this should be the year I cut donuts out of my diet entirely. And every year I don't. Now, I did a better job in 2017. I made a New Year's resolution to start eating better. I'm in my mid-30s now, which is not old or anything. I don't believe that at all. But I'm old enough now where my metabolism is slowed down and I got a bad report about my cholesterol at the end of 2016. And I don't know, there's just something about your first bad cholesterol report that just changes your perspective on life. Where, you know, I used to be able to, like, when you're young, you used to be like a sponge where you could just soak anything up and just wring it out and get up and move on the next day. But I'm feeling like the older I'm getting, I just can't bounce back physically from some of the things I used to do. So I did change my diet in 2017, and I cut the donuts out to a significant degree. But you have to understand that I have genetics working against me because my dad is infirmed with this disease where he raised us practically on donuts. Whenever mom would be out of town or if it was up to dad to figure out what to do for breakfast on a Saturday morning, it was donuts. And I know that he's had to cut them out of his diet as well for the most part, so I guess he and I we're cut from the same genetic cloth. But I'll say this, donuts are not the enemy. In defense of donuts, that is. The enemy really is lack of self-control. And I want to talk about a subject that I think is important this time of year, again, with New Year's resolutions. And we think about things like diet and practicing better self-discipline and exercising more and cutting this thing out or cutting that thing out. And the word that maybe we tiptoe around too often is gluttony. Just plain and simple, gluttony. Somebody actually asked me recently, and this consider this as part of our ongoing series of request sermons. I know that I don't have the same background slide, and it's not on the first Sunday of the month, but this was a request from somebody here at Monte Vista. They asked me recently about gluttony, and is gluttony really a sin? Is gluttony really that big of a deal? Can you point to any single Bible passage that just comes right out and says that gluttony is a sin? And how do we define gluttony and what really is the problem with it? So I did come up with a couple of passages that I'd like to read by way of introduction here. Have your Bibles turned to Philippians chapter 3 and let's begin in verse 17. Philippians 3 and verse 17 says, "Brethren, join in following my example and observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in us. For many walk, of whom I often told you and now tell you even weeping, that they're enemies of the cross of Christ." And what makes them enemies of the cross of Christ? What is about their life? What can you see about their life that defines them, that makes them an enemy of the cross of Christ? Well, he says in verse 19 in particular, "whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their minds on earthly things." And to me, that embodies the spirit of the gluttonous person. When your God is your appetite, when your appetite dictates to you the decisions that you make and how you live, and that's all that you care about, not what your decisions are doing to you, but just what your appetite is leading you to consume. And your appetite will always ask for more than what you really need, won't it? I mean, after all, how many of us have opened up that bag of potato chips and our appetite keeps telling us to eat one more chip, and before you know it, we've finished off the whole bag. And then all you're left with is your tummy feeling bad and that sense of guilt like, this should never have gotten this far. But it's your appetite. Well, another passage is Proverbs chapter 23, beginning in verse 20. Do not be with heavy drinkers of wine or with gluttonous eaters of meat, for the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe one with rags. So I guess I would say, if somebody's asking if gluttony is really a sin, if gluttony is really that big of a deal, I would respond with this, that if God tells us not even to be with a gluttonous eater of meat, if He tells us not even to associate with the glutton, then don't you think He would also say, don't be the glutton? Don't be the glutton? Next, let's consider the man who had it all, speaking of the book of Ecclesiastes. And go ahead and put a little bookmarker there in Ecclesiastes. I want to get to that here in a minute and talk about Solomon, somebody who allowed his appetite to dictate for him the course of his life and his priorities. But before we get to that, we need to understand that it's no sin to enjoy an abundance. Okay, when we talk about gluttony, I always feel like as a preacher, there's some subjects that you have to tiptoe around a little bit more. You just got to kind of be careful when it comes to some things, because somebody will always say, well, what about the potluck? And I fill up my plate at the potluck, and I love the Golden Corral. And I'll say, shame on you if you like Golden Corral. There's a lot better ways to spend $10 than at Golden Corral. But I want to make it clear, at the beginning of this lesson, there is nothing sinful about enjoying the things of this life. Inherently, at least. There is nothing inherently sinful about enjoying an abundance. And we have people in the Bible that we can read about who had a lot of things and who gave credit to God for the abundance that they had. Abraham did not believe he was rich because it was an accident or because of luck. Abraham believed he was rich because God blessed him. And the same goes for people like Jacob. And for Job, Job gives God the credit. Even after Job loses everything and his wife tells him to curse God and die, he says, will we accept good things from God and not bad things? He believed that his good things came from God. He wasn't rich because of coincidence. He wasn't rich because of accident or luck. He was rich because God blessed him. The same goes with David and with Solomon. And God encouraged them to enjoy the blessings that they had around them. There is nothing inherently sinful about enjoying an abundance. And Solomon points this out as well. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, notice here in verses 24 and 25. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? That as long as you keep God in mind and God is at the forefront and you give Him credit for the blessings that you have, there's nothing wrong with enjoying those blessings. Later on in chapter 5, he points this out in verse 19. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, He's also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. You are not a glutton if you appreciate the gift of God. You're not a glutton. My children were not being gluttonous when they jumped into the Christmas presents on Christmas morning. They weren't being gluttonous when in a single day they received a half a dozen gifts apiece, because they were gifts that I gave to them. And I wanted them to enjoy their gifts. They weren't being gluttonous when they simply accepted the things that I gave to them. But there's some considerations that we need to keep in mind. Solomon pointed out his own life and the ultimate dissatisfaction that he had when he allowed his carnal desires, the material things, to run and regulate his emotional and spiritual state. He talks in chapter 2 about all the things that he had, and he begins in verse 1 mentioning all the things that he had built and the beautiful houses that he had and the gardens that he planted and the forest that he planted and all of the slaves that he had and the concubines that he had. He says the pleasures of men, fill in the blank of what he means by that. Solomon was somebody who had the resources to have whatever he wanted, whatever he wanted. He summed up his life in this way in Ecclesiastes 2, verse 9. I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me, and all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. Anything I wanted, I had. Anything I wanted, I had. I didn't refuse them. And that's an important point in our conversation about gluttony. There are times when it is right to refuse. The donut is not the enemy. But eventually, you have to say, no thank you, I'm done. Solomon didn't do that. Everything I wanted, I took. I did not deny myself anything. There was no end to Solomon. For him, if there were 12 donuts on a platter, he ate all 12 of them. For Solomon, if there were 700 wives that he wanted to marry, he married 700 wives. And if that wasn't enough, if there were 300 concubines to add to all that, he got 300 concubines. For him, it was never enough. There was no stop. There was no regulator. There was no limiter on it. Everything he wanted, he took. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, he said. I didn't withhold my heart from any pleasure. And in conclusion, verse 11, thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. No profit under the sun. And he ended up feeling just like all the rest of us do when we eat the entire bag of potato chips and just feel guilty with a greasy hand to deal with. He ended up feeling bad about it. He didn't actively keep in mind that his life was not made of his possessions. As Jesus even put it, even when a man has an abundance, his life does not consist of his possessions. And Solomon suffered incredible emotional and spiritual distress because of his lack of self-control. Oftentimes, easy access to resources brings out the worst in us. If you recall a story from Numbers chapter 11 where God blessed the people of Israel with a number of quail, and they were so eager to eat the meat that they stuffed their faces with it. And it was practically coming out of their nostrils, they were eating it so fast. And God ended up judging them because of it, because of a lack of self-restraint that they were showing. So somebody might ask the question, is gluttony really that big of a deal? Well, here's my answer. Gluttony is a big deal when I consume without any thoughts of the future, when I approach decisions with reckless abandon as if life is like a giant going out of business sale. So yes, gluttony is a big deal when gluttony causes this in my life. A couple of passages here to think about. In Isaiah chapter 22, really, really sobering passage here. And in Isaiah 22, beginning in verse 12, you'll probably recognize it once we start reading it here. Therefore, in that day, the Lord God of hosts called you to weeping, to wailing, to shaving the head, and to wearing sackcloth. And instead, there's gaiety and gladness, killing of cattle and slaughtering of sheep, eating of meat and drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. Now that's the attitude of the glutton. The glutton says, you never know how long you're going to live, so you might as well just live it up now. The glutton says, eat right now without any concern for the future. Don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry about your cholesterol. You can worry about it when you're dead and in the grave. That's their attitude here. Let's just eat and drink for tomorrow. We'll probably die tomorrow anyway, so just live it up. Now, in their context, okay, the historical context here, they might have had some reason to believe this. With their northern neighbors in Israel being taken away by Assyria, with Babylon on the horizon, with enemies all around them, it would be no surprise then that people in Israel had the attitude, or people in Israel and Judah would have had the attitude of, well, if the Assyrians don't get us, the Babylonians will. And if the Babylonians don't get us, the Egyptians will. And if the Egyptians don't get us, well, we'll probably just die of a famine anyway. So for them, from their perspective, they probably felt kind of justified. Like, hey, if you've got something in the bank, if you got food in the pantry, eat it up now. Because tomorrow, you're probably going to die tomorrow anyway. The Assyrians will just come tomorrow and they'll burn our city to the ground and they'll cut our heads off and put our skulls on pikes and we might as well just enjoy it now. But you know what? If life is nothing but like a going out of business sale to you and let's just burn our way through our resources, then yes, gluttony is a big deal. Yes, gluttony is a big deal when the people around you think that you're useless and don't even attempt to get your feedback or your input. Yeah, gluttony is a big deal. When your gluttony has made it so that people don't even consider you a resource, when people don't even take you seriously anymore. Great story from 1 Samuel chapter 25. And I want to read one verse from there, but I'll sum up the rest of the story just so you're kind of aware of what's going on here. There's a man named Nabal in 1 Samuel 25. And the man is wealthy. And this is the time where David is sort of wandering around the countryside, kind of like Robin Hood. He's on the lam running from Saul. And he's kind of a do-gooder helping people out with a band of merry men, so to speak. And he kind of takes care of Nabal's servants and the people out in the pasture land. And so David expects that there's going to be some kind of, you know, reward for this. Like, if my men need some resources or if they need a bite to eat, I suspect Nabal would share with us because we've been good to him and we've watched out for him. And when Nabal rejects David, says, I don't know this David guy. Who is this David? I'm not helping David. Don't help him at all. David's infuriated. He's infuriated and he gathers his men together. He's going to go kill Nabal and his family. Nabal's wife, Abigail, who's, by the way, one of the great characters from the Old Testament, in her wisdom, her patience, in her forethought, she meets David along the way and provides him with a bunch of resources and convinces him to calm down and not hurt his hurt her family. She says, my husband is an idiot. He's an idiot. His name is Nabal, which means fool, worthless person. His name is Nabal, and he is Nabal. He's an idiot. And David calms down and walks away and goes home. Now look at what she has to say here in 1 Samuel 25:36. When all is said and done, so Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she didn't tell him anything at all until the morning light. He's basically a non-factor in his household. And if the way that you eat and the way that you drink and the way that you... if the way that you live makes you a non-factor in your family, or a non-factor in the church, or a non-factor in the community, then yes, gluttony is a big deal. But gluttony is also a big deal when I've embarrassed my parents, when I can't manage my affairs, manage my money, keep track of my grades in college, when my parents have to look over my shoulders to make sure I'm doing everything right in life. When I've embarrassed my parents, then yes, my gluttony has become a big spiritual problem. Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 7 has this to say, he who keeps the law is a discerning son, but he who is a companion of gluttons humiliates his father. So if you're living a life that is humiliating to your father, maybe it's time to think a little bit about your choices and how you are living. We need to take responsibility for our prodigal living, our wastefulness, our credit card debt that we've accrued. We've got to take responsibility for those things and not humiliate or embarrass our parents. Gluttony is also a big deal when I find myself justifying unreasonable indulgences on mere technicality. And I'll say this, that there are times to celebrate. Because even in the Old Law, in the Old Testament, God built into the Israelites' calendar days of celebration. There were feast days built in their calendar. And God did expect them to enjoy their harvest time. But holidays only mean something if they're different from the routine. Thanksgiving is not a sin, my friends. And I know that maybe we joke about it every now and then. We'll talk about gluttony during the holidays and say, oh no, do a lesson on gluttony the month after Thanksgiving, or going to do a lesson on gluttony right around the holidays. We'll kind of rib each other a little bit about, I don't think Thanksgiving is gluttony. And the reason why is because Thanksgiving is different from the rest of your days. And you know, when a feast day or a holiday or a wedding or a joyful celebration, when a time of abundance and celebration is different than your routine, that's not the same thing as gluttony. Gluttony is having Thanksgiving every day. That is gluttony. You know, we have to keep that in mind. We have to keep that in mind. We all know what reasonable indulgence looks like. And so we need to stop pretending that it means nothing. We all know what reasonable indulgence looks like. And the reason why I point that out is from a couple of passages here. In 2 Peter chapter 2, notice what Peter has to say here on this subject. In 2 Peter 2, 13 and 14, it says here, suffering wrong is the wages of doing wrong. Speaking of false teachers, this is what he's talking about, apostate teachers here. They count it a pleasure to revel in the daytime, their stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you, having eyes full of adultery and that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed, accursed children. You know, we know what that looks like, don't we? And the point I want to bring out there specifically is this idea of they count it a pleasure to revel in the daytime. What Peter assumes is that everybody understands there's something doubly wrong about reveling in the daytime. As if reveling at all is bad enough, to revel in the daytime is kind of it's doubly wrong. We all know that there is reasonable indulgence, and we all know where the line is drawn. Where eventually you kind of cross that line from reasonable indulgence to, man, you're taking it too far. That's too much. And Ecclesiastes 10 is the same way. Where in Ecclesiastes 10, the writer assumes that we know what the reasonable line is. In Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 16, woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad, whose princes feast in the morning. Okay, what's the idea about feasting in the morning there? It's the prince who wakes up in the morning and the first thing he does is just indulge, indulge, indulge. And his whole day, it starts with indulgence, it ends with indulgence. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time, for strength and not for drunkenness. Through indolence the rafters sag, and through slackness the house leaks. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment. Wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. He's being sarcastic there, by the way. Now, the point from Ecclesiastes chapter 10 is, he's saying, you are a blessed people if your prince, if your king, if your leadership knows when it's the right time to eat. To eat at the appropriate time for strength, and not for drunkenness. And cursed are you, O people, whose prince eats all the time and does nothing but indulge. There's a reasonable time to eat and enjoy and indulge, and there's an unreasonable time. And I think we're all smart enough, we ought to know that. But gluttony is a big deal, and this is the last point along these lines. Gluttony is a big deal when I'm regularly using up gobs of resources in short spurts. Good budgeting appears as a steady stream of savings and spending, where you are saving and spending in a way that looks consistent and regular, and you're not just going through gobs of resources all at a time. A good diet is the same way. A good diet is fairly even from day to day, so that 365 days out of the year, on a fairly regular basis, you're eating about the same amount of calories every single day. That's a good diet. That's what it looks like. Gluttony, though, is gobs of resources, piles of food, piles of money. That's what gluttony is. The glutton has money burning a hole in his pocket that he just has to spend. The glutton is someone who makes huge purchases on credit on a frequent basis and never pays them off. The glutton is the one who eats and drinks until the pantry is empty, not until when he has had enough. And I think the prodigal son is a perfect example of that. The prodigal son took his entire inheritance, and according to Luke 15, verse 13, blew through it in a short amount of time through wasteful and indulgent living. An inheritance, by the way, that he probably could have lived off of the rest of his life if he had just rationed it the right way. That's gluttony. Gluttony is burning through an inheritance in a matter of mere months. A glutton is anybody whose indulgence becomes a distraction or a detriment to serving God. And that's a big deal. So you're wondering, is gluttony a big deal? Yes, it is. But we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about a few solutions to the problem before we close for the morning. And the first solution I would offer is this. Welcome the limiters in your life, such as input from parents, input from elders in the church, books and articles on money management. Listen to Dave Ramsey on the radio. I mean, there's plenty of resources out there that can help you learn to limit the way you spend money, the way you eat food, the way you go through your resources. Finally, read nutrition labels and let the facts sink in. You know, you get that froofy drink from Starbucks every day, but then you look on Starbucks' website and realize it has 550 calories in it. You know, let that sink in for the first time ever. You know, when you're spending $5 every day on a 500-calorie drink, it's time to start rationing life a little bit better. It's just like, let those things sink in once and for all. Because the information is there. We just need to avail ourselves of it. Look at your bank statement. Check your bank statement every day. Get the mobile app from whatever bank you're using and check it every day. Know what's in your bank account. Know what you're spending on restaurants. Know what you're spending on clothes. Budget things. The information is there. We just need to take advantage of it. Second, while you should never try to be anybody but yourself, it is okay to admire self-disciplined people and try to emulate their habits and their methods. You're not trying to be that person, but you are trying to take whatever forms of self-discipline they use to be the best version of themselves so that you can be the best version of yourself. I've always liked the way that it's put in Ephesians chapter 4, because there is a spiritual side to this as well. In Ephesians 4, verse 28, let him who steals, steal no longer. I think you could probably fill in, let him who is gluttonous be gluttonous no longer. Let him who wastes God's blessings waste them no longer. But rather, he says, let him labor, performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with him who has a need. And if all of your resources are being frittered away on senseless, vain things, you're not able to share with those who actually have a need. Because there are people who really have needs. Third, be guilty about your guilty pleasures. Actually be guilty. We say guilty pleasures as if it's a joke. And if it's not something you should be guilty about, don't call it a guilty pleasure. You know, we'll say like, oh, what's your favorite guilty pleasure? I like to put extra whipped cream on my pumpkin pie at Thanksgiving. Okay, you don't have to feel guilty about that. That's not a real guilty pleasure. But I'm telling you, if your guilty pleasure is something you ought to feel guilty about, start feeling guilty about it. Recognize the way that godliness and self-discipline are linked with each other. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7, one of my favorite verses on self-discipline. The way Paul puts it here is so perfect. Have nothing to do, he says, with worldly fables fit only for old women. On the other hand, he says, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. For bodily discipline is of little profit, but godliness is profitable for all things, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. Self-discipline is linked with godliness. We are vessels for God, and we're put into His service. And as 1 Corinthians chapter 9 puts it, have you buffeted your body daily? Have you made your body a slave to God so that it can be in service at any time that it's needed? Any time that God calls upon you, are you ready to jump in and act? Think about the example that you set. That just because something is lawful doesn't mean it's beneficial. Doesn't mean that it's uplifting to other people. Paul makes this point to the Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 13, he says, if meat causes my brother to stumble, I'll never eat meat again. And in chapter 10, verse 24, let no one seek his own good but that of his neighbor. And if the way that you're living and the way that you're spending and the way that you're eating and the way that you're drinking is causing somebody else to stumble, well, maybe it's time to start putting other people first instead of yourself. Some of the people in Corinth had very little. Some of them had a lot. And as we studied in 1 Corinthians 11 in our Bible class period, this was causing great disunity in the congregation in Corinth. And last of all, start small. Discipline begets more discipline. And discipline in one area of life will spill into other areas of life. I can use myself as an anecdote, but I think you can also think about the times in your life where you've practiced self-discipline and it has affected other parts of your life. Now, you know that I run a lot now, but I haven't always run. I ran in middle school, I ran in high school, but when I got out of high school, I got to college, I just got busy with life. It happens to a lot of people. You get busy with life. You go through college, you get married, you have kids. And I had gained about 45 pounds from when I first got married to that point that I started running again. And I know you're thinking he could use 45 extra pounds probably, but on this frame, 45 pounds is a lot of weight. And I don't know, there was just something about it where I just thought about my weight and thought about my health and thought about my children. We had had Sterling, and I think Rebecca was pregnant with Heidi, and I just thought, I've got to take better care of myself. So I went out for that first jog after, I mean, it was like a 10-year break. I mean, like a 10-year break from running. And it was hard. And it was not comfortable at first. But here's the thing. I found that the more I ran and the more I disciplined that physical part of my life, the better my prayer life got to be. And I don't know what the link is. I can't explain in practical terms what the link is. Perhaps it's just the time out on the road with the repetition of your steps and the silence of it and just the calming nature of it. Maybe it's the endorphins that you get from exercise. I don't know what the link is, but there's something about, for me, physical discipline translated to spiritual discipline. And I started to pray better. Discipline in one area of my life spilled over into discipline in other areas of my life. And maybe you found the same thing, where you changed your diet a little bit. But as you changed your diet, you found it was easier to concentrate on your Bible study time in the morning. Or maybe you devoted a certain amount of time every day to meditation or just silence, a half hour of silence in the morning, and you found that you couldn't help but pray during that silent time. I just feel like when you can practice a little bit of discipline in one part of your life, it's going to change every other part. Or as Jesus put it, when you can be faithful in a little thing as a servant, you'll be put in charge of bigger things. Or you'll be shown faithful in bigger things. It's just food. I know. We spent a half an hour talking about diet and budget and exercise. But that's not what we really talked about for a half hour, is it? We talked about discipline. And if you can discipline yourself in something like your diet, and if you can discipline yourself in just a little bit of exercise, or if you can discipline yourself in just cutting back a little on the money that you spend on entertainment or food or that sort of thing, if you can discipline yourself in those little areas, Jesus will trust you with the big things. The servant who's faithful in a little thing will be faithful in a big thing. And you'll be able to be disciplined in your prayer and your Bible study, and your evangelism, and your worship, and in how able you are to talk to other people who've been caught in sin. You'll be able to counsel people and teach people. You'll be the strong one when others are weak. You'll be the leader when people need to be led. People will look to you because you've been disciplined. Disciplined. So again, is gluttony a big deal? Are donuts really that big of a deal? Well, it's not about the donuts. The donuts aren't the bad guy. The discipline is the issue. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. Discipline yourself right now and focus your life on spiritual things. Stop being distracted by the physical, by the carnal, by the worldly, and finally devote your energies to things that count, eternally speaking. Become a Christian right now. Become a Christian right now. Whatever spiritual need, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.